Welcome to this episode of DebtWired. I'm Adam Simoon, Head of High Yield at DebtWire Europe. On this episode, we speak to Carson Block, CEO of short seller investor Muddy Waters. This podcast will examine what credit risks and operational red flags short sellers focus on when selecting trades. We will then ask what have been the best Muddy Waters short sell trades implemented. We also ask why the real estate sector is risky and what short opportunities exist in the sector currently. Additionally, are there any other sectors or geographies for short trade ideas? Lastly, we explore the difficulties of short selling in the era of reduced secondary liquidity and legal risks such as CDS orphanage events. Welcome, Carson. What credit risks make a good short trade?
It's difficult for me to speak to things from the perspective of a typical credit investor. We are activist short sellers, so what we're looking for, whether it's with equities or with credit, we're looking for significant information that the market is not aware of or that the company has misrepresented. And it's generally historical information. So we're not making an argument usually about the future. We're making arguments about the past and saying, well, since the past is probably different than you, the investor, have understood it to be, or significantly worse in some ways, then you should be able to extrapolate that the future will be worse. So that's pretty esoteric. And especially when you get to credit world, there's not a lot that activist short sellers have done in credit, and specifically credit only shorts. Probably the short that we did that was most middle of the fairway from a typical long short credit investor's perspective would have been Group Casino in 2015. We did that also. We were involved in the equity. We were involved in the credit at both the operating company Casino level, as well as its immediate parent company Rally. In that situation, so if we're thinking about things from a casino type perspective, the thesis there was that the company was effectively far more levered than it appeared from the consolidated financials. So Casino reported consolidated leverage a little north of 3 turns. But when you actually looked at its proportional ownership of EBITDA, it was really about 9 turns of leverage. So I think that when you think about what activist short sellers look for that could be most relevant to your more traditional long short credit investors, it would be leverage terms that are significantly greater. And I think, for example, if you look at recent piece by Gotham Research on Grifols, that I think was the primary part of the thesis, is that the actual leverage is much higher. Now, when you get into things that are much more specialized for activist short sellers, like the work that we've done on Vivion and also CPI, and these are both European property investors, that's a lot more funky. But the red flags that we're looking for are related party transactions in those instances. And I think you have to overlay this, and I don't want to get too far ahead because I'm sure we'll get into this, but you overlay that with the risks that I think are presented by Europe and the risks that are presented by real estate. And so when those two intersect, European real estate, and then you get a related party dealings on a fairly regular basis, that's when you have this witch's brew for some real problems, in our view.
Thank you, Carson. And you mentioned Casino. What have been the best other short sell trade ideas Muddy Waters have implemented in recent years?
Well, first, I think we have to address the best other short sale trade ideas, because that was not, that one ultimately went the way we said it would go, but that took many, many years to play out. And that was not, it was not definitely not even a top 10 trade that we've ever done. But in recent years, in terms of reaction on days one, the most recent one that had, a tremendous reaction, and this is equity, is DLocal, DLO, which is US listed. And it's a company that we'd found is actually, it's a payment processor focusing on EM and FM countries. And we'd found that it was committing fraud. That sort of reaction that we got on day one there, when we get something like that, another good one, a good comparable would be NMC Health. And NMC Health is probably, I mean, that's the most recent from start to finish great trade. The thing collapsed within a couple of months into bankruptcy. I mean, it was a far larger fraud than we even understood it to be when we reported on it. But what we got in the case of both NMC and DLO on days one was massive, I think roughly 60% drop in the equity prices. And that has to be due to shareholder pledges or, you know, share pledges by significant shareholders, you know, when you see that the bottom fall out of the equity. So that's something that we generally aren't going to be able to be aware of in advance of publishing. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the last, I mean, really profound, this company turns out to be significant fraud and it's confirmed and it's gone, that would have been NMC Health.
Turning to the real estate sector, why is it risky and what short opportunities exist currently there?
Well, the issue with real estate is always the subjectivity of the valuations. This element of real estate is not particular to Europe. I mean, this is a global phenomenon. So if you look at this one trial, I think civil trial in New York City, where Trump is a defendant, you know, he's accused of massively exaggerating the values of his properties and also the square footage of his properties, apparently doubling the square footage of his apartment in Trump Tower. So because of the subjectivity there, and the other thing is, you know, it's funny, every time we do something in real estate, you know, the companies will throw back in our faces, oh, we've had these independent valuations done, you know, by Jones Lang LaSalle or CBRE. But, you know, it's annoying that people actually care about these things in any way, because, you know, if you look at how auditors, which do have a statutory duty to the company, how you not that infrequently get total audit failures by these global audit firms. Well, imagine a situation in which there's zero statutory duty. And that is the case when you have these property valuation firms. So these valuation processes are often manipulated. So in the case of Vivian, one of the tricks that they use to manipulate the property valuations, they set up management companies of their UK hotels. And the UK hotel, the management companies were paying these rents. And these rents were inflated, basically. Like, that's what we showed, that these were non-economic levels of rents. And our view is that Vivian was basically inflating asset values across the board to raise more money. And by inflating asset values, you know, you throw a multiple of, you know, you put some multiple on that in terms of how much additional money they're able to raise. And if you have to break some of that off to run through as rent expense to support inflated asset value, then it's a completely economic transaction for them to do it. Unethical, but completely economic. So that's one way they manipulated their hotel valuations. Another was that they entered into these, I think at least two hotels, I'm not totally fresh on this, appear to be housing refugees in the UK. So they have these government contracts. And yeah, I'm sure the rent looks okay at the moment, but our investigators saw that the properties were in a, to put it mildly, state of disrepair. So there's a lot of deferred CapEx there, but that doesn't make it into the valuation. So that's one way that you can manipulate the valuations, is through related party payments. And Vivian also appeared to be doing that in Germany as well, where they had this, what we felt is, and we think we showed, is an undisclosed related party called Rents 24 that was supposed to be it's like a knockoff of WeWork. And so that appeared to be a significant tenant in a number of its Berlin properties. So we suspect that they were able to manipulate the NOIs of the properties that way. So that's one flavor of manipulating property values. What we've seen with CPI is cherry picking comps for land banks. You know, we think that valuation firms are pliable enough to know where their bread is buttered and that they'll be happy to oblige if you want a higher valuation. Also, if you stick in intermediary entities, or it's a, you know, so a lot of times you can say, well, what was the actual transaction price here? And well, but when you don't really have a bona fide third party that's selling or transferring the property to you, as would be the case of when your controlling shareholder is flipping a property back to the company. Yeah, you really have to, that's another easy way to manipulate the valuation. So because valuation at the end of the day in real estate is so subjective, so easily manipulated, that makes it a problematic area. And then, as I said earlier, with these companies, you add on what I think is a unique dysfunction, regulatory and legal dysfunction endemic to Europe. What would the perfect scam be? And I used to think that a biotech equity scam would be the perfect scam, but I've since come to believe that a real estate company in Europe, that'd be the best scam to run if you were so inclined.
Are there any other sectors or geographies where there could be short trade ideas?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, I think anything in Europe, or I think Europe, just the structure of it, presents the opportunity for a lot of misrepresentation by managements, if not outright fraud. And the reason for that is when you think about the way Europe's structured, and even UK post-Brexit, I mean, the markets are still fairly well integrated, right? Money, capital from investors is flowing throughout Europe, whether it's the EU and UK. So investors are investing, money is flowing throughout, people move freely throughout Europe, materiel moves freely throughout Europe. But when something is potentially wrong, because there is no supranational regulator or investigative body, that's when you get to this point at which Europe is still very much balkanized. We've been short several companies in recent years, whether it's credit or equity, like this French listed company called Solutions 30, that have been domiciled in Luxembourg. So you can envisage a situation in which the tiny country of Luxembourg has its regulator, probably, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm just kind of guessing that in terms of employees in enforcement relative to number of companies to enforce or to investigate, I would imagine they're probably a little bit understaffed, but it doesn't matter because when you look at these companies, the questionable conduct is never in Luxembourg. It's in Italy or Hungary or Germany. And so if you're going to investigate a company for misleading, potentially fraudulent financials, you need cooperation from investigators and enforcement authorities in those foreign countries. But they have homegrown cases of their own, cases for which they'll get all the credit. It's not somebody else's collar, basically. And so I can't imagine that there's much cooperation at all in these investigations of potential financial fraud and wrongdoing. Contrast that with the US, and the SEC, I think, is woefully deficient now when it comes to investigating and acting against issuers. But I mean, they're so much better equipped to do it, though, because with the US, it's a federal system. It's, you know, a federal investigative body, and, you know, and can prosecute, or the DOJ can, you know, has responsibility for the entire United States for prosecuting these multi-state financial crimes. But you just don't have that in Europe. And so as a result, Europe really is the best place to run a financial scam. And I used to say that probably the best scam in the world, financial scam, or at least involving public markets, would be a publicly traded biotech company. You know, the idea is that you find some drug that didn't work out and you go and you get a couple scientists who are on their fourth divorces and, you know, can sort of lend their PhDs as faux credibility and you can pump the stock. And that, look, that's a great playbook if you, you know, if you're so inclined. But I think Europe just offers far more opportunity because of that balkanization of the investigative and regulatory authorities versus the integration of the markets and the people. So yeah, Europe is, I think, going to perpetually offer up opportunities to people like us. The only question is whether there's sufficient liquidity in the names. And of course, if we're talking about equity, Europe has that 50 basis point short disclosure threshold, which does really change the playing field. But if you took that out, I just think the level of wrongdoing in Europe is probably well beyond what investors assume it is.
What are the difficulties of short selling in the current era of reduced secondary liquidity and legal risks such as CDS orphanage events?
Well, when it comes to credit, liquidity is an issue. A number of the companies that we come across, if we're looking at credit shorts, if there just isn't sufficient liquidity to get a meaningful position on, then it's just not worth it. There's nothing to do. I mean, in terms of CDS for us, it's pretty rare that we find that the things we're looking at have CDSs. Now, obviously, casino was different. Casino did have an active CDS market. But I think when you're looking at things from an activist short seller perspective and you're looking for significantly misleading financials or presentations of facts by management, most of those companies, from what I can tell, don't even have CDS markets. So you're not concerned about that. You're really just concerned about the liquidity of the bonds themselves.
Carson, thanks for sharing your views with us today. To our audience, thanks for listening to DebtWired. I'm Adam Samoon. You can download or listen to more episodes of DebtWired on Apple and Spotify,